Yes, indeed. And actually, if you'd allow me, I'd like to quote from a biography of our mystery convert. The biography of a mystery convert is called "The Last Years of a Rebel," which was published in 1967, which I think was just a year or so after her death. But this is what the biographer says about Roy Campbell as regards his relationship to our mystery convert. Roy Campbell represented a great deal to her. Not only was he a poet whom she greatly admired, but he was that rare thing in her life, a champion. Perhaps because she had proved herself to be so formidable, it was not often that she was defended by her admirers and seldom, if ever, defended physically. She had an Elizabethan appreciation of a man who could use his hands as well as his head, and she responded to Roy Campbell's championship with an entirely feminine gratitude.
That's a great that's a fond remembrance of Roy Campbell. And of course, I understand that Roy Campbell was quite a foreboding character to begin with.
Yes, well, there's a wonderful story, and I can't remember whether it was to protest against the person's attack on our mystery convert, or whether perhaps it was an attack upon Roy Campbell's own poetry. But there's a wonderful story about the poet Stephen Spender. At a poetry recital in London, and in the midst of his poetry recital, the door swings open at the back, and I think a somewhat inebriated Roy Campbell, limping with a walking stick from a wound he'd got during World War II, walks up to Stephen Spender without saying the word, punches him on the nose, and then walks out again.
What did Spender do to deserve this?
Well, Spender had attacked Campbell. They actually became enemies. Campbell wrote poetry. Spender was basically a Marxist, and he ran away from Britain at the start of World War II to come to the United States. And Roy Campbell considered him to be a traitor and a communist. So they were enemies, but this is typical of Roy Campbell. You don't think about a poet who's willing to wield his fists as well as his pen.
I love it. Just a little factoid here about Stephen Spender then. When the Space Shuttle Challenger crashed in 1986, and Ronald Reagan went on at a memorial service, and he was memorializing the seven Challenger astronauts, he quoted Stephen Spender.
He did, really. You don't remember in what context?
I still remember it. I don't remember the poem, but he quotes Stephen Spender's poem, "Those Brave Souls That Reached Out to Touch the Surly Bonds of the Sky."
Oh, wow. Wow. I admire your memory, Mike, I must admit. That's good. Anyway, we need to remember as well, and to be fair, I'm not sure how Stephen Spender ended up, but another enemy of Roy Campbell's was W.H. Auden, who was also, somewhat militant homosexual and also ran away to the United States when the war began. Auden became a Christian and became a great champion of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings and a somewhat conservative figure in the final years of his life. So we need to remember, and that's what we're really, if you like, what we're doing in this series, Literary Converts, that we shouldn't judge a person by one static moment in their life. We're all homo viator. We all men on a journey. The journey should be to heaven. That's the purpose of life. But in other words, we're hopefully getting older and wiser and learning from our mistakes. And, we shouldn't sort of point the finger at somebody who was young and stupid if they grow beyond that and grow in wisdom and virtue. Of course, if they're 75 years old and they're as stupid as they are when they were 25, then they deserve everything they get.
Well, and Reagan must have been a reader of Spender's, because he also quoted him in his famous 1984 June the 6th D-Day, a 40th anniversary of D-Day speech. He quoted Spender.
Well, right. Call me a cynic, Mike, but presidents have speechwriters, and I suspect this speechwriter like Spender. But call me a cynic.
And that speechwriter would be none other than Peggy Noonan.
Oh, well, that now it's beginning to make a bit of sense, huh?
But I didn't know the Marxist part of the story. Okay, let's get back to our list, our mystery literary convert. Just another little tidbit here from Joseph's book about the story, another story about Roy Campbell wielding his fist. And some of our mystery literary convert's friends said, that was just something she made up. It never actually happened. And you relay that in the book, but here's how it was presented. Elizabeth Salter, the Australian novelist and biography who served as Sitwell's secretary from 1957 until her death in 1964, wrote the following. The critic never tired of insulting me, our convert told Salter. And Roy Campbell, decided to teach him a lesson. Roy was a very big and enormously strong, and he simply knocked him flat. The critic was terrified and crouched where he was on the floor, and Roy said, if you ever insult, insert mystery literary convert and lady's name here, as I then was, again, you know what will be coming to you. And she added, he never did until Roy died, and after that, it started up once again. So the critic ceased his criticism for fear that Roy Campbell might come after him, and that was the end of that. Joseph, we'll take a little respite here, and we'll get this week's errata. And then when we come back, we will actually read from and learn about our mystery literary convert's conversion, and we'll also read from and learn about her enjoy and hopefully grow from some of her poetry. So this is the Piercing Truth show here, and this is our Literary Convert series. And every week we bring you little known facts or errata about our mystery convert to help you get to know this episode's convert a bit better and maybe even help unravel the mystery of their identity. Now, for this week's errata. Our convert and her brother made their first lecture tour of the United States in 1948, where she triumphantly performed her poem, Facade, at the Museum of Modern Art, also known as MoMA. The American literati who attended included Marianne Moore, Tennessee Williams, and Elizabeth Bishop. When our convert returned by herself 2 years later for a second tour, she had even bigger plans, more dates, and more cities. A stage spectacle at the MoMA was planned, starring our convert for the opening of her tour. It was to be centered on a new poem she had written about the role of England in poetry, set to an original score and accompanied by dancers from the School of American Ballet. When our convert's choice of composer fell through, she insisted on taking the stage as Lady Macbeth to perform the sleepwalking scene from that play, among others, though she was warned that this would be a bad idea. But she pressed onward, saying she chose Lady Macbeth because she amuses me, because the part suits my voice, and because she was one of my ancestresses. On stage, our convert declaimed Shakespeare's lines in a loud, trilled monotone. Her baffling performance as Lady Macbeth, as well as photographer George Platt Lynn's portraits, which were published in all the local society pages, sealed her fate. The reviews were uniformly bad. John Mason Brown, for example, described her performance in the Saturday Review of Literature as all boom and incantation, less designed for dialogue than for a Gregorian chant, lacking in any emphasis except a maintained and indiscriminate overemphasis. And then he complained that Shakespeare had been murdered along with Duncan and Banquo.
That wraps up the Historia portion of our show, and now brings us to this episode's Dial B for Murder, Father Brown-inspired mystery puzzle. Listen to the clues, put your Chestertonian thinking caps on, and see if you can deduce who the killer is.
Holmes, have you heard? Professor Palladium, a harsh and much despised classical scholar of ancient Roman history at the local university, was hospitalized after one of his students came at him with a knife.
Yes, I know. And then in the hospital itself, he turns up dead, poisoned.
How ironic.
Yes, poisoned by his nurse.
Why do you say that?
Well, because of this note he scrawled out while dying. It says simply, IV. And the nurse inserted his IV, which must have been laced with poison.
I see. Who else had access to him in the hospital, Watson?
Only three people. Officer O'Reilly from the 4th District Major Case Squad, his department secretary, and his mother.
It's elementary, my dear Watson. One of those three people is guilty, not the nurse.
Good gracious, Holmes. What makes you say that?
Perhaps our audience can tell us.
Did you get all the clues? Have you consulted with Father Brown and know the answer? If so, send your answer to Father Brown at crusadechannel.com and listen to the errata portion of next week's Piercing Truth, Economics with Soul, for the answer and your chance to win an autographed copy of Joseph Pierce's Literary Convert's book. We'll return to the Piercing Truth in just a moment and enjoy some of our Mystery Convert's most famous works as this episode of the Piercing Truth continues.